Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Lads on Tour. I'm Elon Musk Parody, and with me tonight are my co-host, Elon Musk Parody, and our special guest this evening, Elon Musk Parody.
Thank you very much.
So hopefully that joke's still topical by the time the podcast gets released.
I guess.
Yeah, so do I. So obviously that's not the case. I am your host, Stars of COVID, or Frank, as I'm trying to rebrand myself. And with me tonight are Dr. Ivermectin.
Hey.
And Jordan Wilden. Unfortunately, Brent can't be with us this evening, but he will be with us in the future. So let me tell you a little bit about Jordan. Jordan is a digital investigator. He researches extremism, hate, and disinformation. He's currently the Senior Digital Methods Manager at the Institute of Strategic Dialogue, and he's also a software engineer of some renown. He is the creator of Telepathy, which is a Telegram login tool, and a former journalist at Logically.ai, which is where I first became aware of Jordan. And whenever he worked at Logically.ai, he actually was the person who broke the Heartleak story, which we will get onto in a little bit. So many hats. So Jordan, what have I missed?
There's a lot of things. I've been a journalist for quite a while now, previously working with Deutsche Welle, which is Germany's international broadcaster. So that's where I was doing a lot of investigative journalism before then, and social media management. And then I went freelance and just went everywhere in between. So I kind of floated around until like very much sticking with what I'm doing now, which is just kind of all of those things rolled into one, hopefully helping make research a bit more organized.
I suppose we have to ask is, have you ever been paid by George Soros?
No. If I have, I don't know about it. The amount of times that people have said I've somehow been paid by someone or other, if that's the case, someone needs to tell me, and my bank balance should be higher.
Yeah. I had somebody who asked me two or three times, could not accept that I wasn't getting paid for this. And I was like, no, this costs me money. And to be fair to him, what I didn't disclose was that I do have some shares in Novavax, and therefore I sort of have a vested interest in mRNA vaccine technology failing, because then Novavax gets me richer. But so far I have made minus 90% of that investment, so don't ever listen to me in terms of share advice. So obviously the thing that brought you really into my orbit, Jordan, was the heart leaks. I we're not going to talk about it very much, because obviously there's a whole lot of stuff to get through this evening. But in terms of heart leaks, so you got the material. What did you do with it?
It was kind of an interesting situation, because it just like arrived. So obviously then sitting in the position of like being a journalist, sitting there and verifying that the person that leaked it was who they said they are, and going through the process of then like checking and verifying files and things like that, making sure, okay, this is actually accurate. This is, you know, where it says it comes from. Going through the process that the login that they used was the actual login that worked, and it did. I know that that's the case, and to myself, but like checking all of those things. And then it was kind of a 48-hour crunch between me and the co-author Nick Bakovic of just like, how do we go through months of chat logs to work out what the hell is going on here? So the story that I kind of often tell with how it worked was, it was sort of like we had little sleeping patterns where we'd work together for a bit, and then someone would take a nap for a hot second. Nick went through and manually read nearly everything. I went through and I was essentially just text searching continually for anything of relevance, at the same time going through all of the images and stuff like that, and all the metadata, and confirming that people were who like they were in the chats. And kind of doing all of that connections to understand, you know, who each of these people are. And yeah, like it was just a mammoth session that feels like an absolute blur by this point, but trying to get a good overview of the whole thing prior to all of the, as we've seen since, many individual stories that came out after that.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. So much stuff. And obviously Logically published, Daily Dot published, the BBC didn't publish, ITV didn't publish, the Times didn't publish, the Guardian didn't publish. There's any number of organizations that, you know, major organizations which didn't publish. And it's something that I've always sort of struggled with because to me, it's a major, major story. It should have been, boom, front page of the Sunday Times, front page of the, I was going to say the Telegraph, but that was never going to happen. Front page of all the real newspapers.
Not with Alison Pearson there, that's never going to happen.
So why do you think that, you know, logically in the Daily Dot published, but the major ones didn't, maybe it wasn't as big a story as I thought, maybe, you know, those other things which they're not equipped to do?
Yeah, well, I mean, I could already tell you in terms of just the Daily Dot going for it, it kind of landed on us at the same time. And I know that the editor that was dealing with that at the Daily Dot was furious at me for publishing first. You know, obviously we, as logically being the sort of like outlet in the organization it is, the doing all of the editorial was something that we were doing independently on the side. And just because things were there and things were worth looking into and we had the skills to be able to do it and know that we're being correct there and had the independence. After that, it's then talking to journalists. So I had moments of speaking to other journalists from other outlets of being like, okay, how can we go about this? And, you know, part of me would be like, oh, there's some like grand conspiracy as to why they're not like publishing anything. And it's mostly bureaucracy. Because you have an editor that sat there and be like, how can I confirm all of this and go through all of this and then publish in time for it to not be drowned out by anything else happening. And that just freezes things. So then you get maybe 4 days later that could have done that. And then someone else like Byline Times or whatever has already done something else. And then it looks like you're just sort of copying over. I sincerely believe in most cases there, it was just that like their worry about making sure that they could verify all of the things. And in a few cases, I had handed over parts of it and was like, here's how we know that this is correct. So in terms of the files with the metadata, being able to like verify exact things at exact times, being able to verify as those people, in terms of, you know, there's a bunch of other information in those files that would never be published because it compromises like personal data. But, you know, we can be certain that the person that is sharing their phone number is them because their phone number is attached to other things. So, you know, you can go through and do all of that. We were just doing that at lightning speed and then double checking it and kicking the tires. And you've got then news teams where like maybe you'll get a reporter that can get on it who's not necessarily technologically equipped to search through everything. So then has to have a slightly slower process and an editor that goes and does all of that. I mean, it was just the position that we were in and the people that we had to be able to check that and make sure that we are like absolutely correct. And then maybe also lawyering. So we could have that in a responsive way, being like a for-profit company, of being able to just be like, okay, right, we can get someone to check over this very quickly. Whereas if you're the BBC, for example, you've got journalist, editor, lawyer, back to the editor, maybe back to the lawyer, getting it right, and then will it happen? So resourcing, bureaucracy, most likely.
That's quite interesting. So that's logically in Daily Dot would be much more nimble organizations.
Yeah.
And maybe we should have asked Tom Whipple this whenever he was on last. But yeah. Obviously you have the ability to move much more quickly. Mm-hmm. But with social media, with Twitter, with WhatsApp, with everything, rumors spread so quickly now. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that major organizations need to become more nimble to cope.
Yeah, I think so. And this is, there's partially kind of, and I hesitate to say it, and I'm sorry to any of the like journalism colleagues out there that will be hearing this. I think there's sometimes a technological skills gap. It depends on how people are broken up on different beats and where they've come from. Like my background has been looking into those things. And, you know, I can sit there and like grep a file and get a bunch of information because I'll just search it and search it on the command line in a very text-based way. That's something that that's a skill that I have that isn't super common. And it feels really normal to me, but I know that's not something that a bunch of people will be doing. And it's those little things that kind of speed up those processes. It was the same thing with, and we'll obviously get onto this later, with like doing investigations on Telegram. Telepathy was made to make that easier. So it's just like to be able to go like, here's a process, here's how I can automate it, and then making sure that it's right. And then rather than doing several checks for several different channels, or if you're doing research on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, and it taking 4 hours each time, you can go, okay, I'll take the bulk of this work, and then it's 20 minutes each time because the computer's doing the rest. And I think that will catch up. I think that's going to happen. It's just going to take a while.
You mentioned telepathy. You may as well tell us about telepathy. Plug telepathy.
Go right into that there. Yeah. So telepathy is like OSINT investigation toolkit, I think is the best way of describing it now. This very lovely reviewer called it the Swiss Army knife of Telegram tools, and a command line piece of software at the moment that can archive everything on Telegram, can look at where all the forwards are, can give you an idea of when people are posting, how often certain people in groups are posting, that kind of thing. It started just because I was trying to look at the Telegram channels that are connected to each other. And do pretty network maps, because then I got paid more if I had an article with data in it. And then kind of just grew from there, because sometimes you need to archive everything that's happened on January the 6th, for example.
That's proof.
To make sure there's all the proof there. And over time of just doing different stories and looking into things in different ways, you go, okay, this is exactly the process. I take this data, I do this math on it, and then get these numbers. That just became part of the tool. To be able to do statistics on, like I say, like the top posting members or the top commenters in a channel. I'm just taking like the experience of things I've had to do and then trying to be like, how can I create something that is open for everyone to use in this field that just takes that time away, so it can be like a couple of hours rather than 4 days of work.
Yeah, so you're... And again, I mean, again, this is the same thing as, Nick was reading through the Heartaches mm-hmm. exhaustively. Poor guy.
Yeah.
You were.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He's seen things, man.
Yeah.
He has seen things. I mean, the Heartaches is so bonkers. It includes stuff like 5G causes autism and
magnets.
Yeah,
the magnets thing, I'm surprised it never went any further than it did, because the videos of them trying it is just too much. And genuinely believing it with like a small coin, which I like spent too long checking, and I think it was like a 5p or something. And only some of them are magnetic anyway, like could even be magnetic. It depends on what year it was. Yeah. I was like, could I verify this? And I was like, that's too much.
Yeah. It's kind of ridiculous. At some point, because what kind of magnetism requires direct contact in order for it to work? It's a force field. It should attract from a distance, but you have to actually touch it and cock it at a weird angle.
It's a switch.
Yeah.
It's an electromagnet.
I think I mentioned it once on Twitter and someone corrected me because I was like, oh, it's just like, you know, it's just his sweaty arms. And they were like, it's actually not sweat. It's this. I thought, like, okay, here we go.
To be fair, there is something where if at the injection site, you know, if your body starts to sweat a wee bit as your immune mm-hmm. system or whatever mm-hmm. goes, I don't like this. Somebody's poked me in the arm and some of the oils, whatever, caused it to get sticky, but like... whatever. It's sort of, I mean, fair play to you even taking it seriously enough to try and verify this stuff about 5P. Like, maybe this is why I can't work in journalism. I would have just said, look at this idiot sticking a coin to his arm. There was a video actually, and I'll never be able to find it, but there was a video of a guy who recorded himself sticking a coin to his arm and it fell off, and he said, you know what, fair enough, this magnet thing.
Yes, I remember that. Bollocks,
and he, I thought, well done, fair play. To quote Eddie Hearn, this man has a set of bollocks on him to actually,
put
the thing public. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ivor, have you got any magnet stories?
not really, no. I mean, there was always a funny one where... people were like sticking stuff to themselves before they got vaccinated as well, just as a bit of fun. And obviously, the anti-vaxxers would probably say, like, the shedding got you.
Oh, man.
It's been a bad couple of years.
Too many people message me just sticking anything to their arm. Like, just as a response to that, exactly that. I was like, great, I know, you don't need to do this. I don't need to see your arms.
So you mentioned OS Int. Yes. And I'm guessing that the heart leaks, unfortunately, are not OS Int, despite our best efforts, because every time that somebody archives them, hearts get taken down again. So HeartLeaks, not technically OS Int, but what is OS Int? And how does it differ from normal journalism?
Yeah, so it's open source intelligence. It is an intelligence discipline, has been for the longest time. To do the briefest of histories, it used to be like military analysts sat there listening to radio. To put it really, really simply, technically a different thing, but just like read newspapers, like whatever public information is out there. It's solely anything which anyone has access to, and open source in that sense. From my point of view, it's kind of part of a toolkit of many investigative tools that you have out there, especially when you're doing investigative journalism. You know, at some point you'll have documents, and they're not necessarily public and open source. So that's not OSIN. But generally, and I'm going to butcher this and a bunch of people are going to complain to me about it.
No one listens to this podcast, you'll be fine.
It'll come up one day, I'm certain of it. Like OSINT as a discipline itself can be anything from like geolocating, you know, a bomb in Ukraine and giving an understanding exact information as to why, when, how that happened and making informed like intelligence decisions on that. Or it can be going through a bunch of social media profiles and working out how they're connected. Or it can be finding out the identity of a neo-Nazi. And all of those different things, it basically is just like, here's all the available information. How do I look through, process that, verify it crucially, which I feel like I'm shouting at everyone all the time, and then be able to process it into some like actual useful pieces of information. It differs from investigative journalism in that it's just purely open stuff, just purely openly available. Whereas, you know, investigative journalism, you're sitting there and talking to sources for weeks, months, years. You're going through documents, you're putting in freedom information requests to get other documents, that kind of thing.
You mentioned about finding the identity of a neo-Nazi, right?
Yeah.
And obviously, if you found out that somebody who works in the United States Congress was a neo-Nazi, that's very, very important. Mm-hmm. And if you discovered that somebody who cleans the toilets at the local leisure centre votes UKIP, that's probably less important.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's a line between finding out something that's really important and exposing somebody's identity as part of that. And so there's a line at that which is really important, and then there's the potential then for harassment and doxing of of somebody who you disagree with.
Yeah.
How do you work out what side of that line you're on?
Yeah, so the sort of actor attribution stuff, which is, I believe, the best way of really calling it, something I don't really do much anymore. With logically, the line we had was when someone had outsized influence and they were leveraging anonymity to be able to do that. So in the case of Ghost Ezra, one of the internet's most prolific neo-Nazis at a time, he had 300,000 followers on Telegram, was putting out outwardly neo-Nazi propaganda, and that was having an impact in terms of having a huge audience there. That, when it comes to it, is quite a clear cut and dry, like, leveraging anonymity, having a huge audience, putting out terrible stuff. And, you know, just like when you're putting yourself in the public domain like that and then you're avoiding all accountability, I think there is a genuine, like, public interest in then knowing, okay, who is doing this thing. If it's, like you say, just like whoever, the cleaner or the guy that owns the coffee shop or whatever, like, what influence is there? Why? Like, you know, no one's here to police people's opinions. But if you're putting out Nazi propaganda, it's a very, very different thing.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, like, and that's, there's a fine line there. And then also there's, you know, the difference between, like, as I say, actor attribution and doxing, which are like totally different things, despite people throwing the term doxing around. Finding out who this person is and saying, this is the person that's doing that. Like if it was someone money laundering in a big business and you're like, oh, this is the guy that's stealing from the government or whatever. That's just saying this person is doing a bad thing. You're not posting their address or their personal details or like their wife's phone number or anything else. And the skill in doing that kind of thing is not being like, here's exactly where they live and here's the details of everyone around them. Go at it. But being able to understand who the actor is, prove it, and then report on it in a way which also respects the privacy of everyone around them and theirs to a certain degree. We've had cases of this before of like finding certain people out, sometimes through like family members that have been very loose with posting things about them. They don't deserve to be involved in it at all. That's not their problem. Like anyone's kids, anyone's like, you know, closest family members or even friends. No, the person that is doing the awful thing, it's not to like try and take anyone down. It's just be like, there are consequences for being awful. And like not tone policing or anything. It's like, just maybe don't call for the death of Jews, like, or call for the death of like someone just because you don't like the look of them or like, you know.
Yeah. Okay. Have you got anything else to plug then other than telepathy?
I wish I could come here and say like, I have a new thing immediately now. I'm still halfway through programming so many different things. I spend my life trying to work out new solutions for different kinds of problems. At the moment, I'm toying around with being able to properly gravedig Twitter archives. And that's kind of almost all there. But, you know, if an account's been suspended, perhaps because of hate speech or whatever, that disappears forever and then you can't research that. So then you can't understand how someone's got to a certain point or what the radicalization process is or what the influence was. So at the moment, kind of going through and working out ways of kind of reviving stuff for research purposes. Obviously looking a lot at Mastodon at the moment because of how many people are playing around with that. Truth Social's built on it. Gab was built on it. So it's also really helpful from that front as well. So yeah, like I spend a lot of my time thinking like, how can we look into stuff?
I did not know that Truth Social and Gab were based on the same technology. I know that hilariously Parler at one point was based on WordPress, which is not the appropriate technology to build a big social media site.
Wasn't it really insecure as well? And it got hacked like a load of times.
Oh yeah. And they had very strong verification stuff. So they had like people's driving licenses and stuff just sitting on some server that,
yes, they did. I did a story for the Daily Dot on it. Like I have seen those documents. The stuff from Gab was like, there was a huge amount of stuff that just got archived en masse. And it was all very like, it wasn't even necessarily a hack. It was just like open there. Like hi, it was just like, get to the right part of the website.
Stuff's in public.
Yeah.
Because there was the whole thing where they were going to go to, Hart was going to go to a different thing called Slack, but they had to pay for it and they didn't want to because they thought that there were elite Uber hacksters working for the government on the other thing.
I can't remember the name of their web guy and it doesn't matter, but I don't want to be rude about some guy, but everything that I've seen from their technical level is not good. I would not, if I was in Hart, and I'm not, I would not have went along with him self-hosting all the chats. That was insane. That was a ridiculous decision.
Leaving a sign up open, like it was just, it was, there was no like anything else other than just like, oh, we can log in and then done.
My favorite thing about it was whenever they moved the sign up and they had some, they changed the subdomain to some other subdomain, right? But they changed the DNS records to match, mm-hmm. which Ivor, I don't know how much you know, but this, the DNS records for any domain are a public, or a matter of public record, because that's how the internet works. So you could go dnsrecord.info, whatever it was, type in heart.whatever, and see super secret blah 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 dot heart dot, and it's like, ah, there it is.
There it is. No.
So what that led to was, hilariously, somebody was still in Heart's systems for weeks after the story broke. For weeks. So you can, if you go to, if you find the Heart leak somewhere, you can see them reacting to the fact that they got busted. Yep. It's very funny.
Are they blaming the 77th Uberly Hacksaw Sniper Division or something?
Probably.
There was all sorts of stuff. And you know, in some cases, I feel really sorry for some people that were just, like, incredibly dejected. I know, like, it's weird to be like, yeah, so they were all, like, you know, pushing absolutely terrible things that could have cost lives, if not have, we don't know. And then it's like, oh, I was reading through that because that had also then got sent to me and I just didn't have capacity to do any follow-up. And like, actually, it's just sad, like, on a purely human level of, like, their response to that. It was this weird kind of, like, Schadenfreude thing. But just at the same time, I was getting harassed by a huge amount of people that were in support of them, being like, did you hack it? Like, no. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, you hacked, whoever registered and logged in hacked it the same way as I hacked Twitter, by filling out a registration form and entering an email address.
Exactly. This is exactly how I've described it as well.
So we'll move. We will move on from Heart. It's very hard for me to move on from Heart because I find the whole thing very, very funny. But I feel like I've been suitably chastened. So we've talked a little bit about OSINT, and I know that whenever we were sort of planning for this, we talked a little bit. You alluded to the fact that a lot of OSINT is long and boring, drag through tons of public documents to find maybe nothing or to find some small detail after a long time. Can you tell us a little bit then about, I guess there's not going to be something as a measurement of how long would you take to get 400 words of information out, but can you talk to us a little bit about the frustrations of doing this stuff whenever it isn't all just boom, immediately obvious in front of you?
Yeah, I mean, part of it comes with skill, right? There's this, like, various situations of looking something up to verify it or understand something. For example, with verifying events that have happened in an image or video. Like, it could take me 5 minutes if you give me anywhere in London to work out exactly where a photo is, even to the point of checking the time of day, calculating it based on the sun, the shadows, like, all of those kind of things. Like, the huge thing with open source intelligence, and especially with any visual, is, like, everything is, it's an indication of something. So depending on, like, what you need, whether it's just, like, did this thing happen on this day? Yeah, cool. Like, it could take 10 minutes if you're good at it. It could take you 40 minutes, maybe a couple of hours if it's somewhere you've never been or don't have any familiarity with. If it comes to, like, fully investigating something, like finding out Ghost Ezra and aforementioned neo-Nazi, that took, like, I don't know, 8 months or something. But then was also, like, one day a week or something of, like, okay, we'll try and look into something here. You kind of pick at it and get something else. And then after that, you pick at it and get, like, you go in a different direction. You have to confirm that you were right doing that. So, like, you know, there's verification every step along the way as well. And sometimes it can take a long time and then you get a breakthrough. Sometimes it can be, like, a two-day thing. I think a recent report I did mapping out all of Russia Today and Rossiya Sigodna's digital infrastructure, so Russian state media, probably about 6 months in total of doing, like, the digital analysis behind all of that, and then maybe, like, 4 weeks of actually writing it up and making sure that that report came together in a way that makes sense to people. So it can really vary. There's, like, stories that I've looked into that I just never had time to finish off that were, like, based on flight records and stuff like that. And it, you know, you get quicker with it when you've got familiarity with it, but it can be anything from, okay, I have to, like, fact check something and it will get done in a day, or you could do a couple in a day, or it can be nearly a year of work.
So you have to be really committed then to
yeah
to it. And you have to have editors who accept that you're going to disappear for a week and maybe you'll come back with nothing.
Yeah, and have the space to be able to do that. That's why I think also it's quite difficult to sometimes have this in terms of like having good OSINT units in investigative teams, because investigative teams are massively underfunded anyway, and you have to come out with something. You know, it's not just like your normal daily news where you can churn out 4 to 8 articles a day. But you have to go and find sources and then speak to them, and then maybe you're wrong or you've gone down the wrong route. And you just don't know until you're getting into specifically what you're looking into. And fortunately, with Logically, it was a case of like, there was a lot of other work that kind of kept the lights on. And then, you know, it's a tech company. And then the editorial stuff was, we had enshrined our own independent. We just did that and worked on that and made sure that like what we're doing was good. And that's why it could be like maybe one day a week of being able to look into something, or maybe it's like the last 2 hours of a day. And obviously that means it takes longer, but it also means it's possible to do that kind of thing.
Have you been into a situation where you do your investigation and you're convinced of something and you're wrong? And maybe it's went live, maybe it's went to the editor, maybe a colleague has went, "Here, Jordan, this is bollocks, mate, here's why." Like, what's it like whenever it does go wrong? Because it strikes me that it's not impossible for it to go wrong, and people could even feed you malicious stuff and all sorts of, you know.
Yeah. Like, I don't think it's ever got to the point of like anyone kind of externally, as in even externally outside of the investigative team, like to an editor or anyone else above that. I don't think I've ever published anything that was incorrect. I hope not. Also because you've got to trust your editors as well, and then sometimes depending on the organization, the fact checkers that will go through with a red pen and underline absolutely everything. With a lot of the investigations, like you know, I worked with Joe Andrak, who's the head of investigations at Logically at the time, and also with Nick, also very good at OSINT. Throughout the processes of looking into something, there would be that like, "No, mate, this is bollocks." And then you'd be like, "Actually, I know I'm right." And you're like, "Well, prove it then." And then you can. And then you're like, you know, we each change each other's minds, we'd each kick the tires. And you have that kind of like, sort of almost friendly, collaborative sparring of like, "Actually, no, you are fully wrong here." And then you drop it. And then maybe you'll come back to it in 6 months and there'll be something there. But even when someone was confident they were right, it would still be the same like, "No, check it, like prove it to me right now."
Yeah.
For individual steps, then by the time you get up to the level of it being edited, you already know every individual step has been correct, and then everything gets checked again.
So you actually did a tweet thread a few weeks ago where you described people who say they do OSINT because they handle open source.
Yeah.
Open sources, but they don't, for want of a better word, show they're working. So one of the things I find really interesting about a Bellingcat investigation is that they show they're working. It's like, here's how we work this out. Here's the sources we used. Here's how we piece this stuff together. Can you talk us through your thinking around people who use open sources versus open source int?
Yeah. So, I mean, Bellingcat really set the standard with it, and their entire thing was making sure that, like, don't believe us, go and check it. Here's our working. Like, just showing your math. That works brilliantly, and they've done that really well. We've had cases sometimes, or I've had cases of investigations where sometimes, like, I can't show every single step because, like, accidentally you might find someone unrelated, and then, like, if someone follows that thread, and then you have 50 people attack at random, that, like, is a pivot point in an investigation, but it's nothing to do with them, then you have those risks as well. So it's kind of like balancing those things out. But the kind of the key thing that I have a lot of frustration about is like open source intelligence is very strictly, it is from open sources. But the way that we describe it, and sort of, I guess that standard that Bellingcat set is like, you then describe where your open sources were. You make it available for people to check insofar as you can legally do so. In some cases, if there has to be something legally or even ethically do so. It's giving back in certain ways, like with tooling and how you've looked into things. And that doesn't necessarily mean everything has to be free and like no one gets paid for doing their work. but like to at least be able to contribute back to that community, which most of us that are doing this have learned from, including to like, you know, government or military levels where they're still doing the same thing. They're also learning from similar people who have gone, here's my working. Here's how I can tell you like where the sun is and why that building is exactly the length it is and why that shadow means he was there at 2 p.m. And like those people doing that and like going, using it for investigation, giving a tutorial means the whole field moves along. And like, that's the kind of spirit of open source that I feel, and I know a lot of other people do. It's not just your sources, it's also your methods, in the similar principle as open source code, for example.
Yeah. So we should explain open source code, I guess. Open source code is whenever somebody writes something or a group of people write something together and they publish not just the executable, so the thing you'd actually run on your computer, but they publish the code that you can compile to make that executable. That's at a very base level. But on top of that as well, there are open source projects that, although they make the code available, nobody's able to contribute to it. Mm-hmm. With open source code, the array open project, anybody can contribute something if they write something that the project feels is useful. There'll be bugs that are made available and somebody can take a bug, write a fix for it, submit that, and if it works and if it's good, it will get into the code base.
Yeah.
It's absolutely a parallel.
I mean, it's the principle as well. Like Bellingcat works in this very, like, very much like that, but also collaborative way. Like anyone, if it's good, then it could end up in something. But you know, open source code is brilliant because you can sit there and look through the code of whichever app you're using for communication and be like, actually, this isn't secure, or it is secure and I trust it. It's the same with the investigation. Like, here's everything we did. Here's the exact like methods. Here's all the sources. And you can look through it and be like, okay, I don't trust you as the journalist or you as the publication, but the work here is solid.
Yeah.
And like, it's just that level of like verification. It's just that level of trust. Like, I don't think anyone has to trust me or my work or anything like I'm affiliated with. But like the specific, like, okay, you're reading this article. Here's why we know it's right. And that's where I believe everyone builds credibility as an individual, as an organization, is being able to check that and be like, okay, yeah, it's correct.
So one thing with regards to the whole Ukraine war is I've seen like a load of laughably bad, like Russian propaganda where there'll be some Ukrainians, you know, standing around giving a Sea Cow salute. And the reality is it's a group of Russians and the flags have been photoshopped from Russia to Ukraine. So have you ever worked on any of those, debunking them?
Yeah, I've looked into things. I hate to have like the from all sides, you know, there's no one is right in war. There's a lot of stuff that comes up all the time. If we're looking at Russian propaganda, the whole point is like they don't need to put effort in because it will like throw enough people off. It'll waste everyone's time checking it. And then some people will believe it and that's a bonus. Like, it just, if everyone's confused all the time, then it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And then they can react to things quickly and talking heads can say whatever. And then they can go back and change the story 2 weeks later because of like, at least they've got something out that thirst that's just like kind of poisoning the watering hole.
The first season of the Bellingcat podcast, and it's always rude to get an OSN guy who's not on Bellingcat and just talking about Bellingcat the whole time. But the first series of the Bellingcat podcast is all about MH17, mm-hmm. Which was shot down by a book missile supplied by Russians. And there's an episode where they talk about all the stuff, all the disinformation that goes on, and they're just throwing poop at the wall to see what sticks. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the thing. It's not even about trying to cause a coherent counter narrative to what's true. It's just about causing confusion.
Yep. Yeah, the best example of that was the whole like Bucha thing, where the Russians were saying simultaneously, no one died and they're all crisis actors, and the SAS killed them and the Azov battalion also killed them. Like, there's just no coherence there.
Yeah.
So this leads on really neatly. It seems as you have, Jordan, a lot of people who work in OSINT and a lot of people who work in countered disinformation, these things are natural bedfellows. People start in OSINT, they go to countered disinformation, maybe counter extremism. All these things, it's the same people working in those areas. Why is there the overlap? Particularly, I think it's fairly obvious why OSINT and disinformation are related, but OSINT and counter extremism is strange to me, but I think it happens a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I could give you the shortest answer. It's just like people in these fields are just all big nerds. with like looking at like counter extremism, and you know, there are a lot of people that work in you know, like counter violent extremism, counter terrorism, that aren't necessarily in the space, but like the work of people in the space is beneficial. You know, if you're ISIS and you're recruiting, you're posting to social media. How do we measure it? OSINT. So like then it's like it just becomes the technique that's looking into something specifically. And then those people cross over partly because of interest. You know, like my understanding of how like disinformation on social media works came because I've managed social media for major organizations. So I could tell you the difference between like, this is a coordinated campaign and this is one person sat in a newsroom that's tweeted from 16 accounts at the same time, because that's just how their job works. And like,
yeah,
it's terrible social media management strategy, but it's nothing nefarious. It's just like, this is the easy way to send it out to all of the local newsrooms. And that kind of, because of doing that, that lent into being able to understand like how do the analytics part of it work? How does influence work? How are platforms used?
Yeah.
And those kind of things then lead well to each other. You know, counter extremism, especially in the more kind of like conspiracy led extremism and a lot of the stuff that we've seen in various different places or a lot of like white nationalism stuff in the US. There's also the kind of ethnographic factor of like how communities have interacted with each other. Huge amount of stuff kind of just got promoted by 4chan at some point, or 8chan, or pick one of them. Or like, it's just like
Proud Boys. It's never a prime number chan, is it?
It's never. I think it had been at one point, maybe someone, and then they moved on to the next. Prime number chan is going to be the next one. Don't get anyone ideas. So because of that, and because of understanding, you know, how communities interact and the way that people communicate, that is also where those skills kind of just become necessary. You know, if there's protests for like the worldwide demonstration being organized in person across these various cities around the world, they have to organize it somewhere, and that was Telegram. And then you use those skills to work out the mechanics of that and find out it's just like a group of people sat in Germany. Which was the case, actually, with all of those protests.
I only have three more questions on my list, which you'll be glad to know, I guess, but who knows how many more questions we'll get asked. How does somebody get into your line of work? So let's imagine that little Ivor here is 12 years old. Whenever he grows up, he wants to be Brown Moses. He wants to be, I can't remember his real name.
Elliot Higgins. Yeah.
He wants to be Mr. Billingcat. how does he get into your line of work from a software point of view and from a journalism point of view? Because I think you're actually really, maybe you're not unique, but I think it's really interesting that you're so openly both a journalist and a software engineer, and I think that brings you a real strength.
Yeah, it's something I'm quite aware of. There's a few of us out there, fewer than I'd like there to be. More people should be doing this kind of thing, which, great time to tell people how to do it constantly. Like, if you're interested in trying to find out, like, you know, and also like, don't do it alone and make sure there's some kind of help. But like, if you're looking at like investigating war crimes and you need to work out how like certain things work, and that's just something that ends up interesting you because of whatever, play GeoGuessr all the time, and then you'll get good at locating things. If you're interested in trying to like investigate the mechanics of how social media works and why networks work in the way that they do, like try it out. There's plenty of like the advice in terms of like the St. Curious Project, various people out there that will share like full, like here's a walkthrough of exactly how I did a thing, and then just try and replicate it. The great thing about like open source like methods is that you can also see how every investigation was done. And then that helps everyone learn. And that's a really good starting point. From like a really specific journalism point of view, you know, if you start having some of those skills, often the people that do look into that end up becoming more skilled than some of the people that are in certain newsrooms, just because it's, you can spend more time developing those skills, and those people doing investigations don't have that time. Then go in there and see if you can work with people, even if it's just like hanging out and trying to like do something, and like that turns into jobs very quickly. From a programming point of view, I'm kind of a terrible person to give advice because I taught myself and I just worked on things.
Yeah, but that's cool.
Like, but like, and it's so easy. Like, you know, I'd love to be like, try it also. It might work. It might not.
I'm the opposite. I'm a software engineer, and I've got, you know, a degree in a irrelevant thing, and everything's, you know, been fairly formal. But I've worked with brilliant software engineers who, you know, did degrees in other things, or maybe didn't do degrees at all, or whatever. And I think EES, try some stuff. I know that OSINT seems to be done in Python, as does mathematics.
Often, so, yeah.
So maybe don't start with C++.
I'd love to, just because. No one would collaborate with me.
Yeah, and rightly so. It's too hard. So you don't necessarily regard a formal education as being a requirement to get into any of this stuff?
No, I don't think
so. It might
so.
Be useful, but not a requirement.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things like in terms of formal education where like you can do like war and peace studies, you can do international relations if it's looking into those kinds of things. You can do various technology courses. Like, you know, I came from a background of doing radio broadcasting. I could strip down a studio and build it back together like it's nothing. That is helpful in some terms of how I do it, but it's not getting me jobs anywhere except in radio. You know, my master's is in journalism.
I mean, like, I've got the face for radio and it doesn't get me a job in it.
We're all the same there.
A voice for teletext, unfortunately.
And yeah, so like that was sort of helpful in some ways, actually. You know, like it's helped me in understanding how like doctor's audio works, because I know how like exactly how to play around with that and verify those things. My master's in journalism, and that's producing journalism in different ways. I also don't think it was necessary per se. You know, so many people that are doing OSINT just did it, or came from a cybersecurity background and moved over, or came from a background where they were like whether they were military or whether they were just like had an interest and were, I don't know, like woodwork or something beforehand. Like the point here is like anyone can come into the field and bring unique skills and understanding of a thing. Yeah. You know, if you were a meteorologist and you're like, now I want to do intelligence, like great. You will be able to tell me something didn't happen on a day because the weather could not have possibly happened then. So that video was 4 days before. Like those kind of things are all like, it's just looking at pieces of information then verifying it like constantly.
Yeah. Yeah, so you talked about your background in radio production, meaning you've got a good ear for knowing what audio has been doctored, and that's a great example. The meteorologist is a great example, and it's not just that not having the formal education in what looks like a relevant subject is bad, but actually having an understanding of something else, of some other concepts, gives you unique insight that somebody else does not have. Or
absolutely, yeah. Like the great thing, you know, as we said, with like, you know, the trust of people's work, like, you know, this could be someone coming into it new that if they're showing how they're working and they've done something great, they've done something great. It doesn't matter if they've just started out, if they're in university, if they didn't go, if they're just like, they've just come out, or if they've been in, I don't know, like the service industry for 40 years and now like really are interested. The real like democratization and the removal of a barrier to entry there is just like, if you can show it and your work is immaculate, people can see that, someone can verify it, and they're like, yeah, you're right. And do it again and do it again. It's like, okay, well, like, maybe someone should be hiring you. Like, or if like you've innovated on a technique or something else like that. Like, it's kind of really easy in that sense. And I've seen a lot of people that have managed to come into it just by like managing to find something no one else could spot.
Cool. Obviously, we all consume information. We all, you know, have WhatsApp or Twitter or Telegram or Signal or whatever, and people send things to each other and so on. And we're all seeing, you know, stuff that's come from who knows where all the time. And I don't just mean us as in people who are particularly interested in particular aspects of the internet or disinformation or whatever. Everyone is, right? Everyone is. The guy who goes down to the pub and has a pint gets to hear the other guy at the far end of the bar talking bollocks. So misinformation, disinformation, BS is everywhere. How do we sort the wheat from the chaff? How do we know, or how can we tell the difference between something that's true and something that's not true? And I guess that we're not going to spend 40 hours writing Python scripts to parse Telegram to work it out, unfortunately. And maybe 40 hours is an insult to you. Maybe you've worked like, far longer than that on that Telegram.
I wouldn't even know. Yeah, I mean, if I could give you an easy answer, it would be a problem that's been solved by now. You know, we all get fooled. Like, I have had moments when I've like believed something stupid for 5 minutes because my brain's foggy. It's the end of a day. And then like my partner or someone else has been like, Jordan, come on. And I'm like, oh, okay. That was clearly false. Difference is like Den didn't publish about it. Den isn't like a case where I've seen like even like some heads of like NGOs focusing on, you know, whatever big thing and happening in the world at a given time were like published like, oh, there's this awful like situation going down. We're getting through like these reports, and then not verifying it. And then when they're pointed out, like, oh, we still haven't had people on the ground. We need to go and verify. Like, you could have done that first. Like, when you first hear something, like, if you don't know, like, maybe don't spread it to anyone. I think the best thing that we can do, at least to help other people, but that doesn't help us necessarily know something, right? Just, you know, if everyone could slow down a little bit. Because partially why this all works is because, like, you're statistically more likely to share stuff if it makes you angry. And people are statistically more likely to consume it. Like, this has been proven time and time again. If you post something miserable, no one cares.
I'm more likely to believe something if you, what am I trying to say? You're likely to believe something with less evidence if it supports your worldview.
Yes, exactly. So there's that itself. The kind of big thing that I think is helpful is, you know, like we can all try and look into things. Most people don't have time. Like journalism as a whole exists because like not everyone's going to be able to go around and walk around and work out every story that's happening all the time.
Yeah.
Like this is why we have people that do that. So I guess there's sort of an issue with trust in media in that respect, but also just like anyone can diversify their own like sources for things and look other places. And I don't really like, you know, there's been enough research to prove like echo chambers aren't really a thing. But like just at least trying to like view things in a different way. Yeah. Like if we look at somewhere like Twitter, for example, like conversation on Twitter, even when you're like tied up in a little hole, is more diverse than nearly anything prior. And I'd have to share that with you when I can find the exact papers that have it, but it's been a big discussion recently. Yeah.
It would be a shame if having had that question, I just, you know, believed that without looking for any data on it.
Yeah, well, I mean, but then think about it before social media. It's like maybe like you're like, I'm going to say like Californian family, for example, and the times were different then obviously, but like sat there at home and like all like going like, oh, like, you know, all these like conservatives are saying, it's just, yeah, like your family all agrees with each other. One person maybe doesn't. And then maybe their friends that will come over. It's like, that's an echo chamber.
Yeah.
Like we at least can have exposure to other things. To different extents, depending on how much you want to isolate yourself off from it. because it's a global community as opposed to necessarily being tied up by like the 200 people that you've met in your entire life about 60 years ago.
I'd be very interested in that paper, and we'll put a link to it in the notes alongside the OS Curiosity project and telepathy and anything else which we find is relevant. So I will be begging you for links afterwards, Jordan.
That's cool. I'm now going to have to find that exact paper. I think there's been a
few. no pressure.
I think more with the echo chambers, it's like the private groups, isn't it? Like, because with like something public on Twitter, like anyone can respond to it. Yep. Which makes it easier, whereas like with a private group, that can be the like huge echo chamber.
Well, there's one example we could give if we were like trying to skirt keeping on the same topic. Like all of the heart chats, they all egged each other on. And that's where it is. It's a closed space where no one really challenged each other.
I think it was I'm going to have to find this now as well. I think it was a Freakonomics podcast where they were talking about, you know, flexible working from home and so on. And one of the things that I think it was Nick Bloom, who's, you know, a big deal in that space, mentioned was that actually the people who you meet on a day-to-day basis who are most likely to disagree with are your work colleagues in you know, a lot of the time. Because, well, if I remember correctly, and I probably don't, because a lot of the other groups that you're with are self-selecting. So your family isn't necessarily self-selecting, but your friends would be your... Whereas your work colleagues are, well, you're all there because you've been employed to do certain roles.
Yeah.
Which I thought was quite an interesting thing. I will find that and I will add that to the show notes as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's purely like, I think the self-selecting thing is very interesting there because of the fact that, like, yeah, we kind of surround ourselves with either people that have similar interests where they sort of end up generally thinking generally in similar kind of ways, or friends where you can have the least friction when you hang out because you don't want to have an argument about politics or whether or not you've got magnets on your arms. Those things themselves, like, in a way, like, people kind of seek safety in communication so that you're not going to bed stressed every day. So, like, there's sort of parsley in that in how we do self-select those things. But, yeah, now more than ever, like, at least there's enough plurality, but it's also about navigating, like, what could possibly be correct and not, and it's overwhelming. Like, obviously, I know that because I see that every day, but just, like, anyone, like, how are you supposed to know what's real or not? There's an intentional push, as we've seen from like particular nation states, as we've seen from like particularly if you look at some of the news in the US that just won't line up. And you know, we're talking where it's been editorialized and rather than just like your whatever news outlet, people doing commentary on things that kind of just taking a stab at it, and it doesn't matter if people are confused.
I did say I had two more questions, but who knows how many we would get to. Just on that, because you are deep into the weeds in this, how do you keep yourself from going mad? I there's probably a more correct way of phrasing that.
No, it'd be how I'd probably describe it as well. There probably is a correct way of phrasing it. I don't know, like a plethora of things. I could sit here and be like, touch grass. And yeah, like I'll go out and like, just look into the void at sometimes. Doesn't necessarily keep me sane, but it means that at least there's a moment of nothingness. Therapy helps. Like some dealing specifically with like trauma, some general, like and making sure that's always the case. The same way as anyone else does of going and having a beer sometimes. Like most other people also, like you've had a hard week like Friday evening. Not everyone, but...
Yeah, and ignoring that guy at the other end of the bar.
Exactly. It's just like going for it. Like those kind of things. Like I've been in and out of good and bad at like kind of like coping with different things that go on in the world. And there'll be some phases of like, yeah, I can sit and enjoy a book or a video game. And then sometimes where I'm like, actually, maybe I don't want to like shoot at a pretend thing. Or like, I don't want to read because I've been reading all of Twitter for the past 4 days or all of Telegram. Like just words don't work. So it's just kind of being reactive as well to that, of just like, okay, what do I need right now? Do I have someone I can talk to, even if it's someone I'm paying to talk to? How can I relate with other people? Humor, small talk helps. Like realizing the guy at the coffee shop doesn't care. Like, he has no idea what Russia's doing, and it doesn't matter. He needs to keep his coffee shop going.
Yeah, I think it's very important to have relationships with, I hate to say it, but normies.
Yeah, I hate saying it so much, but seriously, like any like people that aren't involved in this, it's super helpful. Because they also have the same stresses in terms of the very, like, boil it down of like, yeah, like I say, like going to the bar because like work's been a bit rough that week. The fundamental is just like work is rough. Or like, yeah, like maybe I've had to have like 15,000 edits on a report I've been writing because it needs to be like razor accurate. Also, the person that's doing spreadsheets for a procurement office somewhere has probably had the same thing when you boil it right down. And those things you can connect to people like on the basis on without even necessarily having to be deep into the weeds of like whatever terrible thing you've seen. And then there are people that can help you with those terrible things you've seen. So yeah, it's kind of balancing all those. It's hard, like not everything works for everyone. Some people like do like watchmaking or something because it takes the mind off it. Or, you know, like I'll build computers out of whatever piece of hardware I find lying around because like that's something that's just distracting. And that helps sometimes too. Like time off, sleep, a good cup of tea.
Yeah. So the one thing about your answer which struck me was that it felt like you're looking after yourself in a conscious way.
Yeah, I think it just comes from kind of like training myself to do that over time. Like, as I say, like I'm no expert at this. Like, God knows, like I'm not perfect at it. But like, you know, when I was doing breaking news, there'd be times when like something big and horrific would happen and we'd kind of all help each other out in the newsroom to be like, okay, you need to go and have a 20-minute walk. Or like something terrible's happened and we'll sit down and like have a debrief in like a shisha bar or something. Of just like something to like remove you from a situation, understand that and understanding other people. And it took me a long time to do the same with myself. It's like, actually, maybe what do I need here? Maybe I just need to like, for it to be slightly cold, I need to listen to a full like Sigur Rós album or something.
I think even in terms of performing your work, it can be useful to get away. So I was struggling with something this morning and I went for a walk, and about halfway through the walk, the correct thing that I need to do to solve my problem popped into my head. Like, people just need that. Even if all we cared about was, you know, doing the tasks we needed to do, rest and getting away is so important.
Yeah. I mean, also another thing that we can sort of drop here, I don't know how much of it is current or helpful in terms of the research itself. Fantastic book called Why We Sleep that has a lot of studies throughout. It's by a sleep scientist. One thing that really helped me was like a specific focus, and I believe it was in that book, of looking at the effects of sleep on PTSD. And it's one of the few things that helps your brain actually kind of like rewire. And part of the problem with people that have gone through severe PTSD is they also can't sleep because of the effects of it, and that doesn't help ease it because your brain has the time to decompress. Like, those rest things then help you move on from a lot of things that happen in life. And obviously PTSD is a pretty extreme example, but just generally
it's relevant, right? I mean, you could absolutely get PTSD by looking at footage of war and stuff. I mean,
Could. Exactly. Like, and like the effects of that, and it's something that's becoming better and better studied. The what was originally called like secondhand PTSD, of the people that used to like have to cut footage from like what reporting in war zones. It's a similar kind of thing that we get in this. Like, I could tell you exactly, and I won't sort of save people from that. I could tell you exactly what things affect me in a strong way and what things that I'm almost feeling guilty because it doesn't affect me. And understanding all of those things and your tics and what works and what doesn't in terms of helping and what affects you and what doesn't is obviously hard, but at the same time, it means you then know how to work through something that's particularly difficult, or like when you maybe don't need to be in a situation in a crowded room, and just like becoming a little bit more attuned with like, okay, like now's the time to just like do something else.
Okay, Jordan, listen, thank you very much for your time, and thanks very much for the work that you do. I think that you're influential beyond what you even know or understand. And I will be annoying you for links to things to put in the show notes. So yeah,
absolutely, look out for that. Do it.
So that was Jordan Wilden. Ira, what did you make of that?
That was a good one, yeah. I mean, different from our usual content, but it's good to diversify.
It is good to diversify. An interesting guy as well. Like, I mean, to me as a software engineer, right, it's very cool to see how critical those skills are becoming in terms of, you know, journalism.
Yeah, it really is, yeah.
And it's funny as well. He talked about, you know, people getting in from any background.
Yeah.
And I know that you as a meteorologist.
Yeah.
You know, you obviously, as you completed your education there, were able to, you went from being a 9/11 truther to being this is bollocks. Yeah. And it was a direct result of your meteorology.
Similar to Debunk the Funk, yeah.
Yeah. Either tell people they should subscribe and then we'll hang up.
All right, okay. So, yeah. Make sure, and we will come for you if you don't, you subscribe to Brentley's YouTube and also like all our posts on Twitter, because we've got all the open source intelligence now to know that if you haven't done it.
And subscribe to the podcast.
Yeah.
Which, you know, we don't know who has subscribed or who hasn't subscribed to that, but maybe we can work it out. Maybe we can triangulate.
Yeah.
That was Lads and Tour. I've been your host, Frank from Stars of COVID, and Ivor has also been your host.
Yeah, I have.
And we will see you again. Good night.
Good night.
Bye.